I'm here with Anarchists Against the Wall. Tell me about who you are as a group, the history, and where you are at now.
Right. The group gelled together or came together mostly spontaneously, I think, around 2002, 2003. Israeli activists started joining actions by the International Solidarity Movement and International Women's Peace Service in the West Bank, and through the connections that were developed through the experience and through the contacts between Israeli activists themselves, a loose group of Israeli activists came together. From the beginning and to a degree to this day, the group is not very focused on being a group or very focused on creating institutional structure. It came together for a specific purpose and tried to remain focused on it. It becomes harder and harder, as I think, as time goes by. Certain things like group becomes bigger. It has its own internal dynamics that requires some work and some attention paid to it. New people coming in, experience has to be transferred. All of these things are sort of a structure that is essential, even for a group that's not interested in structure, even for a group that wants to stay as focused as it can on action on the ground. And I think it's only natural to do that in a situation like Israel and the occupation of the West Bank, because the actions are so accessible. They happen half an hour sometimes from the center of Tel Aviv. It's so clear what's there to do. You don't need to develop a very very advanced or very sophisticated ideology or a training for people to understand what ought to be done. And it allows you to focus your energies on just going out and doing it, which I think is in some ways quite ideal for political action. In many other places, I mean, people in Britain will probably know very well, it's hard to find the right target and mobilize people and explain to everybody what has to happen or what's the right thing to do now, what's the most effective thing to do. So the group is lucky that these things are clear and not created and shapes its focus to this day.
I read on your website about the village of Budrus. Can you tell us about that? It's important people hear about the emergence of a popular resistance like this.
Right. Budrus was one of the first villages to organize in the mode of resistance that remains to this day. And they form a popular committee, which means it's open to everybody who wants to participate. All the Palestinians in the villages, the committee is open to everybody. It's non-sectarian. This is where you want to edit, maybe. Non-sectarian. Which, when it works well, which is the case most of the times, it avoids the infighting and the intrigue between the different political forces. A place like Budrus is really a very successful example of how unified they were able to be. And another important aspect of the resistance in Budrus that made it so strong was their inclusion of women in the struggle, which is not at all obvious in every village in the West Bank. In Budrus, the women were included in the struggle, played a very important part in it, and everybody, you know, the men have no problem admitting it. And also a combination of some good organizers in Budrus, Ayed and Naim Moral and Ahmed Awad, some some really, really successful organizing on their part, and also they were from the beginning willing to work with the internationals and even with Israelis. Again, not something that's so obvious and and automatic in the West Bank. They were willing to give us a try, and I think it was up to us to try to prove, one, that we could be useful, and two, that, which is just as important, that we're able to work with Palestinians in a way that really respects them, respects their ownership and leadership of the struggle. It's been a historic problem with Israeli peace groups, and that it's quite unusual for Israelis to be led by Palestinians or to get any kind of instruction by Palestinians, and it really takes if there's any kind of political development that we did as a group. I said before that we don't really need to do very much political development, but if there's any kind of political development that we did, I think this is it, that we got it in the Israeli left, or at least part of it, that the right thing and the right place for us to be is in the West Bank, led by Palestinians, in a struggle where they're calling the shots and we're there as guests who don't try to throw our weights around. So that's one of the things that needed to be established in the beginning. And I think it worked quite well in Budrus, also in the fact that they were able to push back the fence off of their land to the Green Line just by the power of their demonstrations, not by a court decision, mind you. Sometimes a court decision would come after the fact to solidify the gains, the political gains done by actual struggle. And then maybe some, you know, credit will be given to the court, the humane and benevolent courts. That in this case, no, it was just the struggle that got the army to reroute the fence off of their land. So that's been a successful example. Other villages followed with a similar mode of organizing.
Do you think it's important that Israelis join the fight with Palestinian communities against the Israeli state, even if it's dangerous too? And what's at stake?
Well, for Israelis, what's at stake is different for what's at stake for Palestinians. 22 Palestinians were killed in demonstrations against the wall. Israelis were injured. Some of them injured badly. Some of them did nearly die. A couple of Americans were killed in the ISM. And another American was, Tristan Anderson, was severely injured and nearly died and will have permanent damage. No Israelis have died. I think it's a bit of luck, but also it does reflect that the army, I think, is a lot more cautious when Israelis are around. And I'd like to think that this is another contribution that we can make to this struggle, that we force the army to be a little more careful shooting at demonstrations. In fact, this is something quite rare, but we do have it in writing that their firing regulations are different when they think that Israelis are around. We have some dissident veterans of the army who got the actual orders, and so it's easy to see that in practice, but to actually see that in writing is quite rare. In this case, we have that. Besides the risk, the physical risk, legal risk, again, Palestinians, I couldn't tell you the number of Palestinians who were arrested and how long they've spent in jail. It's very typical for a Palestinian demonstrator to be picked up at a demonstration and then serve 4 months. The military court system we could talk about that more, but you can imagine the military court system where their Palestinians are tried is very different from the civilian court system where Israelis are tried. The legal risk to Israelis is not insignificant. We are arrested quite a lot, and we are indicted quite a lot, and it forces us to shift some of our focus away from action on the ground as much as we would like. We need to deal with legal bills and defending ourselves in court, defending Palestinians in court. It takes a lot of effort, and on top of that, it's one of those things that is a bad influence on a group, that it forces us to deal with such institutional structures as the court system, and also become slightly institutionalized in itself to deal with it.
Do you get a hard time having demonstrations? I guess you did say a bit about that, but
right.
Could you elaborate a bit more?
Yeah, Palestinians have no right to demonstrate at all. Any group have, it's sort of three or more, maybe it's five or ten more Palestinians who meet to discuss any kind of anything political are violating the military law. That includes if they do it inside their own houses, let alone at a demonstration. So any Palestinian at any demonstration, any time, can be arrested. The other legal mechanism is a closed military zone. The army will regularly declare an area where there's a demonstration, a closed military zone, and it's really a no demonstration zone, and it allows them to arrest people just for being there, and often they do. For the Israelis, the risk is a lot less. For the Palestinians, it could easily mean months. All that would take is that a soldier says a Palestinian pushed him. A soldier says a Palestinian threw a stone, or anything else. There's almost no way to fight it legally.
No trial. Okay.
There is, formally speaking, there is a legal system where Palestinians can have trials and even appeal the decisions, but it's really just a formality. Palestinians are most often remanded without bail. And once that happens, they have a choice of either being in jail while a trial goes on for, say, 6 months or maybe more, or pleading guilty and only getting 3 months or 4 months. You can imagine what happens. So the right to trial is just a formality. The entire process is really decided at the level of the arraignment and the remand hearing. And there's no evidence there. There's no witnesses. It's just a hearing where the state can present evidence, secret evidence often, and there's not very much that you can do. There's actually a movie that came out recently about this called The Law in These Parts. Interviews former military judges, and they're quite frank about the system and why it's designed like that and how it works. So it's meant to allow them to say that there is a justice system and a court system, but in practice, no one... Trials are very, very rare. Our lawyers are one of the very few people who would even bother to put up a defense for Palestinian defendants in court. And our lawyer, a very dedicated and talented Gabi Lasky, told me of a case where she acquitted, which you can imagine how, she acquitted a Palestinian defendant in one of the military courts. The translator didn't know how to translate the word acquittal. So that's the so-called justice system in the West Bank.
Can you share with us some true stories that can be found on your website under press clippings?
Press clippings. Actually, I haven't seen that site in a while. I don't remember. I don't remember what's there. There probably is a. What did get a lot of press was when the High Court, the Israeli High Court, decided to change the route of the wall in Bilin. It's one of the villages that's been started up after, not too long after Budrus, and been struggling now for 7 continuous years. A demonstration, at least a demonstration every week. And after years of struggle, they've managed to win a case in the High Court forcing the wall to move. That must have been... I know that it got a lot of press. You might see that in the press clipping section.
What's your role as anarchists against the wall in the struggle to be in the future, do you think?
It's a good question. I find it impossible to predict what the struggle is going to shape up like. It could go on the way that it does, with something like 6 or 7 villages having weekly demonstrations and us supporting them, coming to all of these demonstrations and trying to do other support outside of the demonstrations, such as some legal support or some press or media work, legal defense, documentation, etc. It could go on like this for a while. I mean, there are struggles that take decades. This form of popular struggle that we've been involved with is going on 10 years. Compared to other struggles, it's not long at all. It could go on forever. We do have the momentum to keep going. I think that our group and the Palestinian villages, after a certain time, the momentum just keeps the demonstrations going. So they're not about to give up. It's been, you know, if they were going to give up, it would have happened already. It's 7 years in the case of Bilin, 7 years of a demonstration every week. They haven't missed a one. They could go on. And we know it costs the army a lot of effort and a lot of political capital. I like to say that if every 3 kilometers of the wall cost the Israeli state so much political capital as did those 3 kilometers on the land of Bilin, maybe it's more than, you know, maybe it's 5 kilometers, but then they would never have been able to build the wall. That this small village and other small villages like it have a disproportionate ability to put pressure on the army and the state. And I think that's the reason that they keep going. They wouldn't keep going if they felt that it's pointless. They can tell, and I think, and we feel it too, that we are able to put some pressure on them. We are able to get to focus the attention of the world on it. We have this combination of contacts, this combination of genuine grassroots organizers in Palestinian villages, and a lot of diverse international support is pretty strong. You know, again, going back to these small villages that with, say, 1,600 people might have a mailing list of supporters who've been to the village, spread out, you know, thousands of people, literally thousands of people spread out around the world. That's I think, a strong combination that that's been developed in this struggle.
What's the response been on the ground to the group? It's such a religious place. Do you think it's important to keep the libertarian message alive?
The libertarian message, it maybe exists as... It does exist in the form of an example. The places where we go, the people that we meet, they can tell that the women and the men and the women work as equals, and in our dealings, we make it clear, as far as other forms of the other forms of, say, libertarian, other libertarian goals such as anti-statism, we're not hiding the fact that we're anarchists. We, and the people that we work with, they can understand that. And I actually think that it's quite an easy idea for Palestinians to understand, that of anarchism. There is a very long and rich history of popular action in Palestine. I think, I can't think of a more deeply rooted tradition of popular action than in Palestine. You know, going back to general strikes, huge general strikes for months in the 30s, up to continuously up to the first Intifada, where every village, every school, every institution just spontaneously rose up and replaced the institutions that were tied to the occupation with spontaneous, their own autonomous organizations, from garbage collection to university education. They just replaced and did it with themselves. So it's not hard in such a tradition to understand a group that says that its principles are direct democracy and it doesn't need leaders. They've seen, you know, they've seen that example on a much larger scale. They realize that a popular movement can be very resilient without leaders. So that part is easy. Some of the other issues that might be more of a concern in our society. Say women's liberation. I mentioned Budrus as a positive example. Not every village, the women come out to demonstrate. And women are not treated
equally
in the West Bank. I'm sorry to say. The worst thing that we can do for women's liberation in the West Bank is to lecture Palestinians about it. So we don't. In fact, women's liberation was far more advanced in the 60s and 70s in the same West Bank. In fact, some of the most progressive parts of the Arab world were in the West Bank. It's the repression of the occupation that's been used as an excuse to deny women's liberation. So it'd be quite perverse for Israelis to come and lecture Palestinians about women's liberation. And if we want to help women's liberation in the West Bank, we should concentrate on our own society and its contribution to the repression of women in the West Bank.
How do you find the outside support been like from the perspective of people that live in both Palestine and Israel?
Well, in Israeli society, there's very little support for our work. We have our own community and a circle of supporters, but apart from that, no support at all. In fact, widespread antagonism and hostility. We don't expect any different. We don't focus much of our work on the on Israeli society. In fact, if there is any dispute with some of the Palestinians that we work with, is that sometimes they would ask us, you know, it's great that you're here working with us in the West Bank, but why don't you also do stuff inside your own society, inside Israel, in the 67 borders? I just think that it'd be really hard for us to do very much. You know, we would have the odd vigil and demonstration and sometimes direct action, but we have very little support inside the borders of Israel. So we focus on what's more effective, and is to join Palestinians in the West Bank. In Palestinian society, there is a built-in reluctance to working with Israelis based on past experiences. based on, in particular, the movement for dialogue, which is self-serving for Israelis and for outsiders who might feel better about themselves and feel as if they're dealing with, how to put it? That's not quite how I wanted to put it. Let me try that again.
It's okay.
In particular, the dialogue movement, which ends up incorporating a starting point of parity between Israelis and Palestinians as the beginning for a discussion. So a dialogue group would start out saying something like, okay, we want to be a space that's open for everybody to feel comfortable and speak. And that would mean, in their case, that the situation is portrayed as a one of an equal comparable situation for Israelis and Palestinians under Israeli occupation and Israelis threatened by Palestinians. I think that's a great distortion of the situation, and that's the reason that there's a lot of resistance in Palestinian society to what they call normalization, because unless the joint action directly challenges Israeli control and repression of Palestinians, in a way it extends the occupation, because the social structures and the terms of the dialogue incorporate the existing power relations. So unless your joint work includes an explicit and meaningful form of resistance, it perpetuates the Israeli occupation. So we have this challenge when we go to the West Bank to prove that we're not there for normalization. We're not there to drink tea. It's a very, a very rich tradition of hospitality. We have to sometimes resist it and make it clear that we're not there for the tea, or we would have tea, but only after the demo.
Do the Israeli population find other things that the government does questionable to do with human rights or refugees, anything outside of just the kind of West Bank? Is there
some of the people in our community are working on defending the rights of refugees that have made their way to Israel. It's become more of an issue in the last couple of years. In fact, just last night, a mob rioted in Tel Aviv and assaulted Africans on the street. Just random Africans that were encountered in the street were assaulted. The police arrested a gang that went around assaulting Africans in the street, including using pepper spray on them. As is typical in such a case, the racism is stirred up by politicians. So there were some cases of assault of, say, Africans assaulting Israelis. True or not, makes no difference. The several politicians, a government minister, and the mayor of Tel Aviv, have made quite a bit of political capital defending the poor citizens from the assault of dangerous Africans. The city distributed pepper spray to residents to defend themselves. Now, not to Africans to defend themselves, only to the Israelis to defend themselves. And some of that pepper spray, I don't know if it's the very same bottles handed by the city, but some of the Africans that were assaulted with pepper spray. There's a good chance that it's the same pepper spray that the city gave them. And it really is, if anybody had any sense of history or understanding of racism, it's so transparent and so reminiscent of the American South in the 50s and 60s.